Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Columbus City Council is expected to vote tonight on a plan to both expand the number of city council seats to 13 and assign 10 of those seats to special districts. All the seats would be voted on at large, which is, I guess, one of the big differences between this proposal and one rejected last year by voters. This latest plan is the brainchild of a special committee appointed by the mayor. The committee has until the end of the month to get the plan before voters in November. Coming up, we're going to have our usual reporters roundtable. Joining us right now by phone is Columbus Dispatch City Hall reporter Rick Ruan. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
A summary of the proposed Columbus City Charter Amendment was presented a few weeks ago. If approved by voters, the new system wouldn't begin until 2021. How would the transition work?
So in 2021, the city would start the process of drawing the lines for the proposed districts if this plan were to pass. The last time we spoke, I believe it wasn't clear yet how those lines would be drawn. And since then, council has put together a kind of framework for that. Council would appoint four members to an apportionment commission to draw the boundaries. A fifth member would be jointly appointed between the Columbus City Council and the mayor's office. Those five people cannot be city employees. They're essentially outsiders to the process. And they would have to come up with three proposals. They'd have to have a bunch of public meetings all over the city. I believe it's nine public meetings that they would have to have. They would give council three proposals, and council would have to either accept one of those proposals or reject all three and send the commission back to the drawing board. Once those are drawn, they need to be drawn before the 2021 election,
right,
when all nine members of council would be up for election at that point. Because remember, we have a seven-member council now. This proposal also seeks to add two seats. So nine seats would be up for election in 2021, and they would be seated in 2022 after that election. And four of the members would be on a four-year cycle, and five of the members would be on a two-year cycle, and they would determine who's on the four and the two-year cycle by drawing lots.
Yeah, okay, so lots of questions.
A
complaint from voters last August, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, but was that they couldn't see the map of the districts. They wanted to be able to see what they were voting on, and nothing in this proposal addresses that.
That's right. This proposal does not have a map. And not only was it a complaint from voters, it was a complaint from the organized effort against issue last year. And you're right. There is no map here. There's just a process laid out how they could ultimately get to a map.
And also, they'd have to have the map by 2021 when that vote occurs. But is it still true that you have to live in the district in which the candidates will have to live in a particular district?
Yeah, that's right. So,
well, how will they know where to live? Yeah,
right. Yeah, you wouldn't really know which district you're running in until the map was done. The way it's been explained to me, they're not taking into account, you know, where these incumbents live. They're not going to carve up the map so that it makes sense to have the seven incumbents all in different districts. So once the map is drawn, then you ultimately know which district you're going to run in should you choose to run.
Another thing, as far as who the apportionment board that they're going to appoint, the majority from city council and then a fifth one from the city council and the mayor. What difference does it make? They're all Democrats. They're all on the same ticket. They're all on the same club.
Today.
I see.
Yeah, I mean, that could very well change when they ultimately decide to appoint those people. If a Republican ever were to get onto council or an independent were to get onto council, then certainly They would have a voice in that. But you're right. Everybody is a Democrat in City Hall right now. And it doesn't look like that's going to change. We have one Republican running for city council in this upcoming election, and there are Republicans in the city attorney and the auditor's races. But right now, City Hall is a Democratic stronghold.
Mm-hmm. Now, council members would draw straws for to decide what term length they would be elected for. Why that? What's that about?
Well, the way that council has been set up is that you don't elect an entirely new council at every election cycle. Half of the council, a little more than half of the council, since it's an odd number, is elected on one cycle, and then the other half is elected on an off-year cycle. So if you're going to elect the entirety, if you're going to elect a whole new council, you have to put somebody on one cycle and somebody on another cycle so that you're not just constantly turning over a nine-member council. They've chosen to do that by drawing lots.
Who draws?
There had been some thought previously to basing it on the number of votes received, but ultimately they came to this drawing lots idea.
Yeah, and so who's actually drawing lots? There'll just be lots drawn for the districts, and some districts will get 2-year representatives, and some districts will get 4-year representatives.
That's right. So the city clerk would, the council clerk would be the person who oversees that process. But I'm not 100% clear on if the city clerk is the person who's drawing for those districts, if the elected representatives are the ones. The lots are not drawn until after the new council is seated. So it would make some sense to have the members, all nine members in a room, drawing those lots.
And then that's the way it will go in perpetuity, that those districts, certain districts will have 4 years representatives
No. Your initial cycle would be the 4 and the 2 year. But once that first 2 year cycle is up for the council members who were on that initial 2 year, in the next election, that would be it for a 4-year cycle. So then you would have a system set up so that every 4 years you're electing, or every 2 years you're electing half of the council.
Okay, and they say that they're not going to draw the district lines to favor incumbents, right?
Sure.
That's what they said.
That's correct.
What, as far as the folks that have been pushing for a district system of city government, you know, the people that ran the campaign for the proposal that was on the ballot last August, how have they reacted to all this?
They have not reacted positively to it. They have repeatedly held press conferences. They've come to council. They've written letters to the council urging them to reject this proposal. Some of them believe that it is a violation of the Voting Rights Act. I've talked with some election law experts who seem to believe that's not necessarily true, mm-hmm. and that in order to actually succeed in any challenge to this kind of system, you would have to see the system in place and the wrong would have to occur before you could really challenge it. You would need the data to back up that this is a violation of the Voting Rights Act. And that's all related to this idea that you could have a majority black district in this system, but the majority white electorate citywide could vote for somebody else.
But there are other cities in the country that have a system like this?
That's true. Much smaller cities. So Reno, Nevada, Sparks, Nevada. And then you have some, I believe there are some county governments in the Pacific Northwest that have a similar system.
Mm-hmm. Council member Shannon Harden, who sponsored the legislation, said that the biggest thing that they heard through the committee's review process was that voters didn't want to be divided up, that they wanted all at-large seats. Is that what you heard, Rick Ruin?
Well, it's a complicated question because the voices that you hear the most are the people who are pushing, who pushed issue one last summer. They are the loudest voices out there. But issue one was defeated at the polls last year. So, you know, it's a complicated question. I know Councilman Harden had, you know, public hearings to discuss this issue. The Charter Review Commission had several public hearings. Those were not well attended. You know, it's the election last year sort of speaks for itself. Now, admitting that there was very low turnout and that an August special election is not going to draw high voter turnout. That's a really complicated question.
Well, the voter turnout isn't so great on these off-year elections either, even in November.
Yeah, you're right.
Will council candidates, I'm still kind of confused about where they're going to live. I mean, how do they know whether they can even run?
Well, in that first election, they're going to be filling all nine seats. So if you and I live, you know, near each other and we think we're going to be on the border, we can both run. We're just running against each other now if we happen to be in the same district.
What if nobody runs from one of the districts?
Now, that's a question that I have not asked nor have an answer to. It's a good one, though.
And any sense about what those districts would look like? Any clues about what they're thinking about?
We haven't gotten any indication of that. The city council policy folks who have put this together have maintained that it's going to be up to the commission. They have some loose criteria that you can't discriminate, you can't violate federal law, things like that. But ultimately, the council and the mayor's office would seat the commission, and then it would be up to the commission to figure that out.
So no directions like keep neighborhoods together, like, say, a German Village or
no.
Short North or blah, blah, nothing like that. Huh?
Clintonville, no, nothing like that.
Okay, Rick Ruin, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me again, Ann.
It's Rick Ruin. He's City Hall reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Kindly got us up to date on what the... Oh, by the way, Rick.
Yeah.
They are expected to vote tonight, right?
So they are. That has been the indication that I have been given all along, but it is unclear how that is going to go. I don't think that this is a necessary slam dunk on council. You often see things pass unanimously on council. I think that there's been a little more division on this one. So we'll see what happens this afternoon and into this evening.
Okay. All right. Rick Ruin, City Hall reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We'll get back to our regular weekly reporters roundtable. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Vice President Mike Pence was in town over the weekend for the Ohio Republican Party state dinner, where he reaffirmed his pledge to undo Obamacare. Also in attendance, State Senator Rob Portman, a key vote for President Trump's health care plan. Portman says he wants to repeal Obamacare, but only if Republicans can replace it with a plan that protects low-income Ohioans now on Medicaid. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Andy Chow. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Statehouse correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carsmyth.
Good morning, Ann.
And correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. Governor Kasich did not attend the dinner, but he worked the crowd beforehand. Was that a big deal, Laura Bischoff?
I was there and I didn't even see him. It was they took over the entire Ohio Union on the main campus at Ohio State. And, you know, they had like a VIP reception area. And I think he was in there with Pence.
Did they let
you in there? No, I didn't. Oh, I didn't get a ticket to that. but it was off to the side. And the vice president and Senator Portman were in there. And I guess a lot of other people. So I imagine it might have been a little bit tense just because there's been this public feud between Team Kasich and Team Trump for, you know, a long time. And it really kind of flared up recently when the vice president was pushing the narrative that 60,000 people on with disabilities were on wait lists because of Medicaid expansion.
In Ohio.
And that's really that's seen as two completely unrelated issues, the wait list for community services for those with disabilities has always been kind of a chronic problem, but it's not really linked to Medicaid expansion. And the response from Kasich's team, his press guy tweeted out, this is fake news. And so it was kind of a...
They pushed back right away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It's another example, I think, of Kasich coming in and... You know, sort of working the crowd and then not technically being there of sort of what he's been doing, which is he's trying to walk this line. He's trying to continue to be connected with the Republican organization that basically ousted him and his people from control of that party. And that was their big fundraising dinner of the year.
Right.
So it's a little unclear whether he's choosing these things or he's gently being asked not to be featured. But it, you know, he obviously gets to come and sort of see the people he wants to see and then have a family obligation at just the right minute.
And if you remember, this is what happened last year in Cleveland during the Republican National Convention. He was in Cleveland. He did a bunch of different events. He mingled with a lot of people, but he never stepped foot in the arena or on the floor. And I know that back then, the decisions he made during the convention have really bothered a lot of Republicans here in Ohio.
Right.
Like you're in Ohio. You're the governor of Ohio. You should show up to these things, even if there's tension, even if it's strange. And I wonder if that's going to have the same kind of response for this. This is the Republican state dinner. Even if it's uncomfortable for you, even if somebody being featured as the keynote speaker is somebody you disagree with, he should have been there. I feel like a lot of Republicans are going to think that.
Perhaps. There's another possibility, though, which is a lot of Republicans are concerned about things going on within the Trump administration. You know, what we hear when we just talk to your average party loyalists, I guess, is some great concern around what's happening in Washington, things like the Russia scandal, things like some dignified treatment of being the president. And obviously now we're watching as it's been ineffective in terms of getting major policy initiatives through the Congress. So I think that Kasich is sort of making a calculus to be able to still appeal to people probably at the national level, some sort of middle of the road American voter who feels like he does that. You know, he calls himself a conservative, but he also has concerns about the Trump administration.
You know. Yeah. Laura,
I was just going to say, I think that the Republican Party overall in Ohio has got some challenges right now. I mean, they have four very well-known candidates running for governor. So you have like kind of a contentious primary and jockeying going on. I think Rob Portman is right. He's walking a real tightrope on health care. He even kind of cracked a joke at the GOP dinner that he had been talking to a lot of Republicans about the health care issue, and half of them told him to do one thing and half of them told him to do the other thing. And now and Josh Mandel is facing a primary challenge from a business guy up in Cleveland. I think his name is Mike Gibbons.
In the race for U.S. Senate.
In the race for U.S. Senate. So and then there's this feud that that the governor is having with the president's team. So I think Jane Timken, the new party chairman, for the Ohio GOP's got her hands full.
And I think the thing that people and like Julie said, the way that John Kasich has been doing things might appeal to on the national level, might appeal to moderate voters. I definitely think it's not appealing to Ohio Republican leaders, Ohio Republican lawmakers, because even though it was a tough situation, Senator Portman still went up in front of people and spoke on the stage. And even though it's all awkward, he still went up and did something and said something. Meanwhile, although he said there was a family obligation, the governor didn't do that.
Right. And you have to remember that because of the way our maps are drawn, they're gerrymandered so heavily toward the party of that area, so that Republicans have run increasingly to the right to get into the state legislature. Mm-hmm. So this hurts them as they try to hold those seats at the state level, at the state house, because they are more conservative than maybe past General Assemblies had been, say, 10 years ago or mm-hmm. 20 years ago. And so our state house contingent is conservative, and they really need the governor as opposed to the president to sort of be helping them.
Right. So I'm trying to figure out, all right, at the state dinner, you have a lot of party officials, you have a lot of elected officials, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of minions in between.
Sure. You got the party faithful. You got there was county elected leaders, statewide elected leaders, lawmakers, you know, Bob and Betty Buckeye types.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the article I read was that John Kasich got a pretty warm reception. Is that just for, you know, when that happens? He didn't actually get up and speak to everybody, though, all at once.
Right. But, I mean, he's still the governor. I don't think he's going to get booed by the GOP Republican Party. Not yet, anyway.
A lot of people were pretty ticked off that he didn't show up last summer at the convention. And I'm wondering, would this be another, like you, I think you said, Andy, is this going to be another
stick in the eye?
Yeah.
Well, and he's on national television constantly bashing and criticizing the Republican administration.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But yet when it comes time to speaking directly to his own party, it doesn't seem to be there. There are events there, and he doesn't seem to be taking advantage of that.
I'll tell you, though, this is a pretty big opportunity for Ohio Republicans or Republicans, state Republicans in general. When you have the president of your party, you know, is of your party, the vice president comes in, big fundraising opportunities. I mean, they just couldn't be doing better when it comes to money, right?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the campaign finance reports are coming out next week on mm-hmm. July 31st.
But as Laura points out, with four people in the governor's race, the big donors are trying to really decide where they're going to put their money, and there are hard choices there. Mike DeWine, the attorney general, is a longstanding, well-known, well-respected, familiar name.
Yeah.
Then you've got John Husted, who's been an up-and-comer, I think, before Bob Bennett died, the GOP chair a couple chairs ago. I mean, he named him as a rising star who they wanted to groom for governor. Now, you know, he's looking at this as his year to come up. You've got the lieutenant governor who...
who didn't show up Saturday night,
right,
by the way.
She skipped.
Which is very interesting.
Well, I mean, you know, when Mary Taylor announced for governor, she distanced herself instantly. Her website distances herself from Kasich. And I think it's because of this thing where... You know, you have to win a Republican primary with conservative voters, and then you have to go and win a general with a very closely divided state. And it's they don't want to commit themselves too much to the conservative labels that they're cultivating right now, because they hope to win the primary, and then they'll have to go up against a Democrat and show that they're moderate.
It's just another baffling move, though, I think, from Mary Taylor. This whole campaign launch, where I think even back in March or February, you thought, oh, she officially announced, or at least we know that she's running now, but she hasn't officially announced. And then, oh, now she has officially announced, but she hasn't done all the events. It's just her the way her campaign is being run is not very traditional, because this is the kind of dinner that you want to be at the with the.
This is rank and file. This is all up and down the state, and you really, because of the way Ohio's is, you need the whole. I mean, you need that. You need that party.
And every candidate got 5 minutes to go up there to speak to the entire group. And then, of course, they mingle with the crowd. They shake hands. They make as many connections as they can. And Lieutenant Governor Taylor wasn't there.
And right. what's interesting is that Renacci, when he gave, you know, he showed
Jim
his
Renacci,
Jim Renacci, yeah, from the Wadsworth. Mm-hmm. He showed his introductory video of him tooling around on his Harley. And it was sort of like an introduction to himself. And I think he probably needed that. And then John Husted showed his biography video and talked a little bit. And then Mike DeWine didn't show any video. He just used his whole 5 minutes to kind of talk. And they did show the Mary Taylor video. Okay. And it was mostly her – the video was like of her reading her speech from her announcement event. So I think I think that left some people kind of scratching their heads.
But I believe I've said on your show before, Anne, that I feel like the question – is complex because we're watching and we don't really know. Does this mean that John Kasich and Mary Taylor are on the outs with an important element in their future? Or is it the other way around, that the Ohio Republican Party is losing ground in terms of its influence? I mean, we've just come through an election where a president won completely untraditionally, without much fundraising, by mostly tweeting his own comments and ignoring the party altogether and the entire party structure in this country.
But Donald Trump had he had the publicity on his side. Mm-hmm. He didn't. He was had so much free publicity, and I just don't see how in a statewide race like this, Mary Taylor.
And John
Whoever
Kasich doesn't have
it.
Free publicity right now.
Oh, John Kasich does, but he's not running for anything yet.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a different story. But when we're talking about Mary Taylor, I don't see how you get out and fundraise and you.
But to build on Julie's point, which I think that political parties in general have a lot less power than they used to. You know, just with the rise in dark money and 501c3s and 4s, they do a lot of the political work. So it'll be interesting to kind of see where the party moves in the coming years.
But I think the big opportunity is not to make friends with the state party itself, but to make friends with all the county chairs. And that was still where Donald Trump did really well, was gathering all the county chairs. And that's another moment where they're all there that, you know, you can appeal to them. Yeah. At that dinner.
Big news on Friday. President shuffled around personnel in the White House. That was fun to watch. New White House communications director, former New York financier Anthony Scaramucci. Cool name. Interesting guy. Thoughts about, you know, what would happen? I mean, Sean Spicer resigns. I guess he's done in August. Hanging on for another couple days. Just your experiences as political reporters covering an organization like that.
Well, I think that Sean Spicer, anyone who works for this administration in that position, has to burn out very quickly. I predict we will see, you know, more press secretaries than we've seen in past administrations, just because it's already a really difficult job, and in this environment where they're walking this line of really discrediting the journalists all along the way as often as they can. I mean, I get the president's tweets on my phone, and I mean, you know, at least once or twice a week. It's
well, there was one this morning.
At least once or twice a day, sometimes it feels like the fake news,
specifically
blah, blah, blah.
Go on. Yeah. So, you know, these folks have to. They have a professional job description that says relate to these people, share information, help them get accurate stories out to the American public. And it's not an easy road to walk, I can't imagine, in this White House.
And I think it'll be interesting to see what kind of where the process is and what kind of new systems they have or not new systems as far as transparency goes. So are they going to continue having off-camera press briefings?
Right.
Or are they going to start making that more transparent? Are they going to have less briefings? Are they going to have more? So I think those things are going to be a good tell of what kind of communications staff they're going to be running from here. But that's what will be interesting to me if they continue to have these off-camera press briefings.
I love his nickname, the Mooch.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because he was saying he wants to de-escalate the tension between the press and the White House. Mm-hmm. And then he also said very clearly that he loves Donald Trump.
Many times, yeah.
Many times. But I think, he's coming in to push out the message and try to, change up the trajectory of the Trump administration.
But he's never done this before.
That's true. Yeah. He doesn't have much of a communications background.
Yeah. None.
But I guess if you're dealing with a president who's doing things that have never been done before, maybe
it could be beneficial.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to do it the way you've always done it before.
I guess some of what I feel is that these kind of jobs, if they're done well, are not particularly glamorous every day or even out front. I mean, a lot of us just, we need to call these people to get information, to get clarification, to get documents. We need to, what we're doing is putting together, our best possible understanding of the facts and the issues at hand. And it's not sexy and it's not always, it's work. And so, yes, somebody who actually knows how to do that is valuable to everybody involved.
We'll continue our conversation with our weekly reporters roundtable this week. You just heard from Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Andy Chow. Also, State House correspondent for the Associated Press, Julie Carr-Smythe. And correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brent Larkin for Cleveland.com wrote the most forceful argument to date. It was in a column for Richard Cordray to enter the Democratic race for governor of Ohio. He is the head of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. He's a former Ohio attorney general. He was a state rep for a time. He clerked for two U.S. Supreme Court justices, was an undefeated five-time Jeopardy champion. All of this was
former
related.
Former state treasurer.
Former state treasurer. How could I forget? And he argues that Cordray's stature has grown, that he might not have impressed voters that much before, but that his stature has grown. Thoughts? Is this an inevitability, as Brent Larkin sort of painted it to be? If the Democrats want to win, they're going to have to run Cordray.
Well, I would say there's a calculation that the party has to make, because Rich Cordray was recently featured in an article about Democrats who are somewhat quietly getting work done in Washington while all of the hurricane happens on the surface. And he was kind of featured as trying to actually do some rulemaking and other things that are advancing the national sort of Democratic priorities. So, would he resign or would he wait to be fired? And is that inevitable? And does that meet Ohio's deadline for getting entered into the governor's race, I think, are all questions that I have about it. Mm. Mm.
Usually people drop little hints here and there, and you begin to read the tea leaves of who's going to run and who's not going to run. And so with the people who are running right now, you kind of knew ahead of time because of these traditional ways. And all these little hints that have been dropped so far are very untraditional, and it makes me wonder if it's really going to happen, because we haven't seen any sort of filing, any sort of exploratory whatever. And so I just don't know yet.
But the thing is, with his position, he's prohibited from participating in politics. And he's steered clear of that for the most part over the years.
Irreproachable.
Over the years, when I've called him on political issues or whatever, he would decline comment pretty uniformly. And the other thing is maybe dropping hints. Maybe this, you know, whoever the friend was that talked to Brent Larkin was the one who... That's the hint dropping right there. You know, I think that Rich Cordray has an advantage if he enters the race in that he could tap into kind of the Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama network of donors and might be able to raise the big pile of money needed.
You're saying $20 million?
Yeah, like $20 million. And that is no joke. That is hard to come up with.
And it's going to be... a real disappointment to the Ohio Democrats if they see an opportunity next year and then feel like they just don't have a candidate that can rise to the level of showtime on election day. I mean, remembering that this happened to them last time when their candidate that they chose, Ed Fitzgerald, did not
pan out,
let's just say. And so, you know, that really was a throwaway in some ways because John Kasich was a very, very popular governor who was running for re-election. But this time it's an open seat. We have a tumultuous thing. All we've just talked about in the earlier segment about the divisions within the Republican Party. They have four candidates trying to divide up the loyalty, the money, the county support, and the Democrats need someone who's really... a little bit better known.
But and at the same time, you know, Rich Cordray has been out of Ohio for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to have to come back and kind of reintroduce himself to Ohioans. The problem with the four Democrats who are already declared, that would be Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, former Congresswoman Betty Sutton from the Akron area, former state lawmaker Connie Pillich from Cincinnati, and Joe Schiavone, who's the
state senator
from the Youngstown area. Is those four candidates are kind of known within their own region or their own cities. They don't have the statewide recognition.
Right.
And I think Cordray starts with better statewide recognition, but it's imperfect because he's been gone for a while.
Yeah, he's got to tap into the support that he did have 6 years ago. I think he's well-liked by independents. I think he's well-liked by white males who could go one way or the other when it comes to party dedication. And if I'm remembering it right, when he did lose to Mike DeWine for the attorney general race, that was the closest of all of the races of that year. And I remember that, you know, that was going to be one that people thought Republicans might be able to sweep, and they did. But DeWine had the hardest time, yet he has one of the biggest names in the state. And it could happen again that if Cordray were to run, he could face DeWine in the general election, and that would be a really interesting rematch.
I do think that the two statewide races that Rich Cordray did win were a little easier. You know, he won state treasurer in 2006, and he was running against the Ashtabula County auditor, who had primaried the incumbent treasurer, Jeanette Bradley, and she was very, very right wing. If you asked her a question about anything in the Treasury, she answered with more conservative talking points, et cetera. And I think, you know, Cordray, he won pretty handily there. And then he won a special election for attorney general after Mark Dan resigned. And, you know, he had forceful backing from the sitting governor at the time, Ted Strickland. He lost the AG's race in 1998 and in 2006. So, I mean, he's won as many statewide races as he's lost. And right. I think he's, even if he runs, he'd have a lot of work to do.
But the environment that we're in right now with people feeling one way or the other about President Donald Trump, I think that Cordray could offer a very interesting dynamic as far as, well, the people who don't like the president could look to somebody like Rich Cordray as like, really a polar opposite, somebody who is not as brash, somebody who's way more calculated in what he says, almost to a fault.
But not as brash.
And I wonder if that could actually, in times where that has hurt him, I wonder if that could really help him in this case, where people are looking for somebody more in that mold.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a good point, that he comes across as very reasoned, reserved, low-key almost, Rich Cordray does.
Well-studied.
Yeah.
Careful.
But which can also work against him, because that's not really a – that's not a really political dynamo that, you know, is going to come in and really jazz up the voter base, who may – many people in Ohio right now, voters might be considering just sort of not – even coming out in 2018. I mean, it's complicated. John Kasich has sent some mixed messages on, you know, what's going on with the Republicans. The Democrats have people whose name they don't know. And we have to remember there's a huge swath in the middle of Ohio that just says, I really need to get excited before I bother to take the day off work and go vote. Mm.
I think there are two things. The things that could help Cordray are also the things that he could get slammed on. One is his position right now, because I remember when Ted Strickland came back to run against Portman for the Senate, he was getting slammed for being, quote, off in Washington, gallivanting in Washington for this liberal, you know, this liberal group for a liberal agenda. And so he was slammed on that for being out of Ohio working for Washington insiders. And I think Cordray could get hit with that, too.
But he's working on behalf of ordinary Americans against the big banks.
But his opponent,
in a general election, you know, because that's going to work well in a Democratic primary. But I mean, Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama are the enemies of the middle voter.
And if you look at the messaging, especially if you were to take what Josh Mandel has been saying in his campaign as he's running for Senate, he's been saying Elizabeth Warren's name constantly, because Elizabeth Warren to a lot of right wingers has become the new Hillary Clinton
standard bearer, right?
Yeah. And right. And so, I mean, you like you said, he's in Cordray could be in with the Elizabeth Warren type. That could work for Republicans to garner support for whoever's the Republican nominee. Mm-hmm.
But as we know, we're an extreme swing state.
Right.
We voted for John Kasich in the primary for Republican last year for president, and then for Donald Trump, two previous cycles. Barack Obama, two previous cycles, George Bush. I mean, so it's not
his
clear.
His two biggest cheerleaders, his two biggest beneficiaries, you know, or biggest cheerleaders, Barack Obama, Elizabeth Warren, in the general election, they're just not going to fly. Maybe by then they might.
Mm-hmm.
At least a Barack Obama might.
And you mentioned the column by Brent. And he made some interesting points about how, in general, over the past couple of decades, Democrats have really struggled to get anybody out to vote in gubernatorial races. So Julie just mentioned Barack Obama won for both of his times, George W. Bush. So that goes back and forth. But as far as governor races go, it's been very heavily on the Republican side.
Well, and the fact that Obamacare has had a very difficult time getting repealed in the Republican Congress— that's the Affordable Care Act, you know, the health care overhaul bill. They can't do it. They're having a difficult time getting the votes, even in a Republican-controlled House, Senate, White House, because a lot of people like it. And it's getting a lot of press around the fact that people are beginning to understand that, you know, it's more complicated, that it's doing certain things that are good, and the other, you know, the repeal needs to help more people.
I wanted to bring up Josh Mandel seeking the Republican nomination again for the United States Senate. He has, you know, has had some conflict now with the Anti-Defamation League. What's going on with him? I mean, he's running in a primary at this point. He's trying to appeal to the farther right of it, but that, you know, going up against the ADL is very risky.
Well, it was a interesting tweet that he made. What he did last week is the Anti-Defamation League, which, you know, has existed for 100 years against anti-Semitism, bigotry, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They had put out a new report on the alt-right and alt-light movements, sort of just a who's who explainer piece on these new political movements, which are kind of to the far right, alt-right being, you know, sort of white supremacist philosophy, and then the alt-light sort of less so in that way, but sort of having some misogynistic and racist tendencies in some of their statements, according to the ADL. So they put out this report, and Mandel basically tweeted, "I'm disappointed to see the ADL becoming so political and deciding to basically hit list people for political beliefs. I don't think that's what they should be about." He doubled down on it, stuck with it even after it caused a flurry, and remembering that he's Jewish, and he said, "Well, I'm the grandchild of Holocaust survivors. I feel that having a hit list of American citizens is a bad thing. It's a slippery road to go down." And one of the folks that because he stood by a couple of these guys who had been listed as alt-light in the report, and one of them went to Auschwitz and did a video responding to the ADL report by basically saying, you know, they would be wise to remember what happened the last time people made lists of undesirables. So it's a very tense situation, I think.
The tweet that Josh sent out also, he mentioned his support for a guy named Mike. I think it's pronounced Cernovich. And that's the person who really pushed out the whole Pizzagate thing in Washington, claiming that there is this pizza place in D.C. where Democrats are using this location for child labor, child sex slaves.
Right, yeah.
This fake news situation that caused a lot of problems. And
it prompted somebody to like go shoot up the place.
And Mandel voiced his support for this person who really pushed out that conspiracy. And so it's been turning a lot of heads how he's come out against ADL, but then supporting these other people. And this is kind of in line with what his strategy has been so far as running again for the U.S. Senate. And it's definitely proof that he's going for this further right wing group, these people who using tactics that President Trump was able to use in gaining support in Ohio, too. So I think he's trying to establish himself as a Trump candidate still.
Yeah, he's talking a lot about he's talking out against illegal immigration and mm-hmm. sanctuary cities. He made a video of himself on the Mexico border, kind of some tough talk there.
He's bashed journalists in his tweets lately, too.
Right. So it's definitely he's taken a page from the Trump playbook.
But he's no Donald Trump.
And it goes back to the whole thing. When people try to act the way Donald Trump acts, is it going to see the same results? And I don't, like you mentioned, I agree. I don't think it will, because Donald Trump had something else going for him that I don't think other people can capitalize on.
Well, and as Laura pointed out, I mean, he's now drawn a challenger from Cleveland, who's pitching himself as a more traditional Republican candidate, a businessman named Mike Gibbons.
Yeah, and I think he raised a pretty decent amount of money right out of the gate, like $700,000 or so. Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's going to be an expensive race. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned. I want to thank you guys for joining us. Julie Carr-Smythe, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well.
Thanks.
And Laura Bischoff for the Dayton Daily News. Thank you.
It's always a blast.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.